Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hi. And welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast from These Football Times. My name is Gary Thacker. The recent decade series covered the 1980s has proven to be very popular, and to round it out, we've gathered together three of the contributors from that series to do a battle in the Brent Rushmore debating hall, to see if they can convince me that their choice of goalkeeper, defender, midfielder, forward and manager from that decade are worthy of a place on the 1980s Mount Rushmore monument. So, without further ado, let's introduce the advocates set to do battle for their selection. Firstly, we have Stu Horsfield. Normally, Stu sits in the host chair, seamlessly guiding people through the various TFT series with panache and aplomb that make Jeff Stelling appear like a bumbling amateur. But tonight, his task is a little bit different. How does it feel to be sitting on the side of the table, Stu?
I feel like I'm going to be a bumbling amateur, if the truth be known. I feel like that's exactly how I'm going to be. I'm excited, but I'm a bit nervous now.
Don't worry, Jeff Stelling is not watching, so you'll be okay.
Brilliant.
Alongside Stu and making his debut on a Mount Rushmore episode is Chris Lepkowski. All ready to rumble, Chris?
I am. I cannot wait to find out who's put forward Peter Hooker or Gary Bailey. It's going to be a great night, I'm sure.
We'll have plenty of arguments, plenty of discussions, plenty of disagreements, and that's what Mount Rushmore is all about. Finally, complete the triumvirate is the man who once said that I should have waited for the many white coats to take me away after I was convinced by the arguments of Anton Panenka above his selection of Michel Platini when we did an episode of the European Championships. Then he went and wrote a book just to prove his point. Aidan Williams, welcome back, mate. And the book was brilliant.
It's scary.
And it took I read it in 3 days. That's how good it was, buddy.
Well, thank you very much for that, but I'm still bitter about your choice that on the Mount Rushmore for that. I still have nightmares about it. So they'll be the men in white coats will be with you shortly.
That's fine. The door's locked, so it's fine. Right, let's get the ball out and have a kick about. Before we kick off, though, a couple of things I should mention. At this stage, only I know the players and the managers each advocate has selected from their initial selections. And all will be revealed in good time. But I'm allowed to say for this episode, there was a lot of similar choices because there were so many great players in that decade. For example, all of the advocates, without exception, selected Neville Searthall as their first choice goalkeeper. So, in the interest of fairness, I deleted that option. And each has now been allocated their second choices. If you think that Neville Searthall should have been selected, he was. But they can't all have the same guy, so there you go. There was also a similarity across defenders too. The one complication, however, was that the two advocates selected John Barnes as their first choice, one in the midfielder slot and one as a forward. So, resorting to established practice on Mount Rushmore debates, Barnes was therefore excluded. So other choices have been given. After all that, however, I'm apt to say that each of the players and manager the advocates will now argue for are either their first or second choices. So nobody's been bumped down to a third choice. So no excuses, guys. You've all got a fair chance. So let's see who convinced me the most. As I said, let's get the ball out. Aidan, tell me about your goalkeeper.
Okay, there are some unlikely paths to glory, but not many go from Highlanders FC in Bulawayo via a stint in the Rhodesia Regiment in the Rhodesian Bush War, brief football spells in South Africa and Canada, and a loan spell at Crewe Alexandra on their way to glory. It isn't a typical CV for someone about to be the goalkeeper for the strongest football team in England and indeed Europe, but there's little typical about Bruce Grobbelaar. Eccentric, flamboyant, athletic, he broke the known conventions expected of goalkeepers in English football. Now, some might say the greatest players hit the ground running and show their quality from the off, but it's clearly far more of a worthy achievement to have overcome initial struggles, battled adversity, and come through it all to reach the summit. That is very much the case for Bruce Grobbelaar in the early days of his Liverpool career. He initially came into an inconsistent and underperforming team in his first season. His erratic style and some admittedly calamitous errors saw him take a fair amount of the blame for Liverpool's struggles. and the comparison to the calm assuredness of his predecessor, Ray Clements, probably didn't cast him in the best of lights initially. But as he found his feet, so too did the team, ultimately coming back from mid-table at the turn of the year to winning the title in 1982. Getting used to Grobler's style was key to that in many ways, I think. He was a goalie well ahead of his time, frequently racing from his box to clear, a confident sweeper-keeper, unafraid to push the boundaries of convention. It all made him stand out as unorthodox, of course. But his athleticism and knack for the spectacular in preventing goals made him both hugely popular and hugely successful. That he was picked as first choice by several successive Liverpool managers, ultimately playing more than 400 times for the club, tells its own story. If he'd been more conventional, would that have reduced his effectiveness? I would say so. Some may want a consistent, safe pair of hands, and Neville Southall say. But the more unusual and unorthodox approach of Grobbelaar was just what this great Liverpool side needed in order for the team as a whole to play to their best. None of his contemporaries were remotely as spectacular, as entertaining, or as breathtakingly athletic as him. No others were as far ahead of their time. No others won a European Cup for their side by pretending to have legs of jelly. No others celebrated winning yet another trophy by walking on their hands on the Wembley turf. And no others were a mainstay of the club most consistently strong and victorious throughout the decade. And most crucially of all, no others rounded out the decade with a mic in their hand in a still iconic song going, Liverpool FC, Liverpool FC.
The timing there was perfect. That's 2:59.41. So not only well delivered, not only coherent, not only cogent, but also spectacularly on time as well, buddy. So, guys, the baton has been the gauntlet's been laid down. The baton's going to be passed to you, Chris, next, alphabetically. So, after that eloquent argument for Bruce Grobbelaar, tell me about your guy. 3 minutes starts now.
3 minutes. Well, what can I say about this goalkeeper, other than the fact that he was so good that he actually preceded Bruce Grobbelaar at Liverpool, and he won pretty much everything: FA Cups, League titles, European Cups, UEFA Cup possibly even as well. And then he decided that he needed a new challenge. I mean, not many people would do that, leave behind the best club in the country to go and seek a challenge elsewhere. Ray Clements did just that. He won 61 caps for England. He was the original sweeper keeper at a time when we expected our goalkeepers to get their body behind the goal and just effing clear it whenever the ball came anywhere near. And here was a goalkeeper who actually thought a little bit more about the game. He had a cohesion with his defence. And it's a scandal, a national scandal, that we had an England manager who would seemingly alternate between Ray Clements, the best goalkeeper in the country, and Peter Shilton, who was not. Must have caused confusion in the defence. And yet, with Ray Clements back there, Liverpool and England, and subsequently Tottenham, had a guy who could not only produce brilliant dynamic saves, but actually had a little bit of ability with his feet to play the ball out when necessary, as and when. He won it all in football. Some of it in the 70s, some of it in the 80s, but he is worthy of being the best goalkeeper of the 1980s, Ray Clements.
Okay, Chris, I like the brevity of that, buddy. Got all the points in there. Lots of trophies, you say, and then after Liverpool, when Grobbelaar came on, he moved on to Tottenham and more success there. So, Stu, coming on to you, buddy. Two good arguments put forward there. You're going to pick a different guy, probably for a different reason as well. This is a real sort of, I like left field selections. And this is a left field selection, buddy. And these are the two guys I'm waiting to see you're going to put forward. But from 12 yards, this guy was an absolute wall in front of a penalty kick. Away you go, Stu. 3 minutes.
So obviously it's going to be no surprise to the 80s decade that I've gone with Peter Hooker. I haven't. So I have gone with the way I've picked mine, just as a little quick brief, I've picked mine with who I wanted to be when I was a kid playing in certain positions. And when I was playing in the backfield and I was stuck in goal, this is who I picked to be. I am also being a passionate advocate against the prejudice that goalkeepers under 6 foot were no good. So I have gone for Paul Cooper of Ipswich Town. In goalkeepers, Aidan spoke very eloquently about Bruce Grobbelaar, and I'm not here to denigrate his. But for me, a goalkeeper has to be consistent. A goalkeeper has to be reliable. And Paul Cooper was exactly that. The only player who was the mainstay right through that Ipswich Town period of success under Bobby Robson. He made 575 appearances for Ipswich Town, won the FA Cup in the 1970s, so I'm not going to count that. UEFA Cup winner in 81, 2 second place finishes for Ipswich Town in the league. In the UEFA Cup winning season, 61 appearances in a single season for a goalkeeper. No loss of form, no injury. As Gary alluded to as well, very much the penalty king. 56 penalty saves throughout his career, including 8 penalty saves against the 10 that he faced in the 79-80 season. And as this is about the 80s, he saved 2 penalties in a game against Derby County in 1980. So that just squeaks in there as well. And like I say, for me, he's goalkeepers, the spectacular, and I will concede that there are spectacular goalkeepers in this discussion. But for me, there is no greater sight than a goalkeeper going full length, making the save, but keeping hold of the ball. For Paul Cooper, there was no palming away. There was no going for the ball with the wrong hand, as is now the fashion. There is no palming it into dangerous areas. Paul Cooper, it was like glue to his gloves. He was, for me, the most consistent and arguably the main reason for Ipswich Town's success, and not dominance, because obviously, as we've discussed, that was very much Liverpool's preserve. But Ipswich, a provincial club, to achieve so much consistent success, the foundation of that success was in that number one shirt right at the back, Paul Cooper, Ipswich Town.
Stu, I see it was left field, actually. It was a backfield selection, wasn't it there, buddy? So, yeah, I got you, mate. Good time again, 2:58.6 there, Stu. So, yeah, okay. Right, so to give me some thinking time, I'm going to come across each of you guys and sort of say, if your guy wasn't in there, who would you choose? So, Aidan, come to you first. If we discount Brucey, Paul Cooper, Ray Clements.
Well, essentially, Stu's argument boiled down to the fact that Paul Cooper's boring. That's what I took from that. You know, he consistent, never dropped the ball, no fun. All right, come on. So you can't compare that to Grobbelaar, obviously. And Clements got binned off for Grobbelaar. But what can I say? Of the two, if I've got to pick one, I would pick Clements. But I think his prime came at the turn of the decade. And then, you know, he was sacked off for someone better.
Chris, coming to you, buddy. I mean, Aidan, I wouldn't say he's sort of aggressive, but studs up over the ball, straight across the shin. So if you can't pick Ray Clements, Grobbelaar or Paul Cooper, Chris, what would you say?
Well, it's an interesting one because Bruce Grobbelaar, not many people know this, but he had a trial for West Bromwich Albion and he was refused a work permit because he simply didn't qualify. And it was during a trial at Crewe when he stumbled in his loft upon a documentation that proved he had a Scottish uncle and therefore qualified for a work permit. So Crewe and Liverpool's plus was West Brom's loss. But I'm a bit reticent to put in a goalkeeper who's basically, who was a bit of a clown. You know, he was the Jan Tomaszewski of his era, maybe a little bit better, and he played behind a great defence. So I'm a little bit mindful of putting in a goalkeeper who had lapses in him. Now, Paul Cooper, as somebody who's 5'7", as somebody who's from and visited Sutton Coldfield, which is where Paul Cooper's from, and watched the brilliance of Sylvester Stallone in Escape to Victory, which is where Paul, Cooper was the artistic director for goalkeepers, I'm going to err with the goalkeeper who saved 8 penalties in 10, even though only 2 of them were actually in the 1980s during that season. I think Paul Cooper is a remarkable custodian who in these giant rich days wouldn't have even got a look in under most managers. And yet there he was winning trophies for Ipswich. I'm sorry, Aidan, but I'm going to go with Paul Cooper.
Okay. You've responded with like for like there, Chris. I like that, buddy. Stu, Now, are you going to be sort of compassionate, or are you going to go join in the free-for-all here, mate? Because your goalkeeper is just boring, apparently.
Well, to be fair, I think Chris summed it up perfectly when he said Bruce Grobbelaar stumbled in the attic. I think that pretty much sums up Bruce Grobbelaar's entire career. It couldn't even keep on his feet at home. So, no, I'm going to be magnanimous to both. I'm going to be the bigger person. To be fair as well, Aidan made an interesting point. I agree. Ray Clemens is an outstanding goalkeeper, and a lot of his work was done in the 70s. I've tried to keep this as very much 80s related as I possibly can, and only looked at the 1980s. So, and again, when it comes to the rest of my choices, we'll see that I hate boring, if I'm honest, apart from in my goalkeeper. But if I was picking the two and I wanted someone to play in goal for my life, it would not be Bruce Grobbelaar. I'm really sorry. It would be Ray Clemens every day of the week.
Well, that's given me some thinking time. I've come to a decision. And it's, okay, it's a debatable one, but I think the Paul Cooper, good goalkeeper, never won a lot of trophies. I think that's probably not going to count strongly in his, although he was playing behind probably worst defence, but, you know, still had Alan Hunter, Kevin Beattie, Russell Osman, George Burley in front of him, so not too bad. I think Clemens, if I was looking at across entire career, Clemens is by far a better goalkeeper, but I think so much of his success was in the 70s, so it just lapped over into the 80s slightly. I'm going to have to go with Grobbelaar because he spent far more success in the 80s than the guys. And, yeah, sometimes it'd be a little bit exciting, but, you know, I think...
Did Liverpool ever seek to sign Paul Cooper, Stu? No.
In fairness, I don't think they could afford him, mate. I don't think they could afford him. In fairness, I mean, Chris mentioned about Sutton Coldfield. I used to work at Sutton Coldfield. I didn't know Paul Cooper had come from there, but that did give me a little bit of sway for a second. But I've got to go with Grobbelaar. Okay, that's my goalkeeper sorted.
Stu, this is how I felt about Platini.
I cannot. I am stunned.
This is outrageous.
Absolutely, it is.
I feel like Gary's going to reveal, take his mask off and reveal Peter Shilton underneath. I don't honestly feel that's going to happen now. It's Peter Shilton sat there who wanted 200 caps and he ended up with 125, all because of Ray Clemens.
In spite of, not because of, that's what this should be entitled. Ipswich won because of, Liverpool won in spite of. I can't believe it.
I'm just going to ask you to pause for a second while I go and get my gavel so I can bang it on the table to maintain some order in this debating hall, gentlemen. I mean,
none of us went for Peter Shilton, interestingly.
It's fantastic. So none of you went for Peter Shilton in any of the three choices. Which is fascinating. I mean, you know, Peter Shilton would have been an argument for a lot of people, but that was great, guys. I just hope we've set the tone there because I bloody enjoyed that. Okay, so we're going to start move further forward to defenders, and I'm going to come to you first, Chris. 3 minutes, away you go.
Yeah, well, I'm going to raise a glass to the genius, a guy who loved the Guinness or two, Paul McGrath, 163 appearances for Manchester United, one of the much underrated centre-halves of his time. Outstanding. You know, you look at the way he played for Man United, for Ireland, composed, lovely feet, really comfortable on the ball. And boy, could he drink on a Tuesday at Paddy Crowan's bar. You know, if you wanted a defender who could refuel and knew how to refuel, Paul McGrath was your man. But listen, taking all of that away, here was a guy who just had the gift, the blessing of being able to read football matches from a vantage point of playing in front of the goalkeeper. There aren't many centre-halves who can do that, who are so good that when your midfield is completely injured at Manchester United, which happened often with Remy Moses and Brian Robson in front of him, he had the ability and the wherewithal to play midfield and be effective as a midfielder. I think Paul McGrath is one of the big success stories of Irish football. Elegant, powerful, quick, good in the air, good on the ground, an ability to rake passes across the pitch. He had it everything, apart from knees. He had, by the end of his career, he had mashed potato instead of cartilages. And yet he was such a brilliant, elegant footballer. And I think that having learned his football alongside somebody like Kevin Moran, he had the ability and the know-how to be hard when he wanted to. But in a Ron Atkinson team, and then subsequently playing for Villa in the 1990s, he had that ability to play at the back, score important goals, and a much underrated player. And I suspect that for all of his refuelling habits, I think that Alex Ferguson made one of his big mistakes when he allowed Paul McGrath to leave.
It's a good call, Chris. Paul McGrath, wonderful player. And, you know, as you mentioned about his dodgy knees, if he hadn't been his dodgy knees, I mean, who knows, he could have been some special, some world-class. I remember a story that we did a podcast with a guy who wrote the biography of Graham Taylor, and he said about when McGrath was playing there under Taylor, he had him use an exercise bike because that was takes pressure off the knees and not running. So he used an exercise bike. And he got off the bike and sort of stood by the side of it and leaned on the handlebars afterwards, and Taylor says, "What are you doing?" He said, "I always push my bike uphill, Graham." Which I thought, you know, well, I hope it's true because it's a classic moment. So, yeah, I mean, it's a great pitch, buddy. It's a great pitch. Going to come to you next, Stu. You're going to go, you can talk about a guy who won a lot of trophies, mate. Away you go.
So, yeah, as I said, players who I wanted to be in the backfield, I never wanted to be a defender. But this person is a player who I have grown to respect and admire and have actively sought out video evidence to back up what a lot of people have said, because as a kid I wasn't interested in defenders, and I've gone for Alan Hansen. And the more I've watched and the more I listen to people and the more YouTube clips I look at, and people nowadays talk about defenders like John Stones and stepping into midfield and all this modern jargon, and we're doing a podcast here about the greatest players of the 80s, and Alan Hansen essentially was the best part of 30, nearly 40 years ahead of his time. As a player, he could go from back to front, you know, in sort of 7 or 8 strides and carry that ball, just glide across the pitch. And not only that, that ability to find the right pass at the end of it. It wasn't a blundering, bludgeoning run from centre half. It was with grace and elegance on what were essentially mud heaps. And once he'd broken the lines, then that weight of pass, that ability to pass the right decision, was almost that of a number 8 or a central midfielder. 620 Liverpool appearances, just in the 80s, bear in mind. 5 league titles, 2 FA Cups, 4 League Cups, 2 European Cups. He does win a league title in 79-80, I've not counted that. He did win a league title in 89-90, I've not counted that. He did also win a European Cup in the 70s. I've not counted that, but I just thought I'd throw those in there for just leave those hanging. A captain, a player who took over as captain after the trauma of Heysel, a player who was captain during, obviously, the momentous, tragic events at Hillsborough. He was a player who embodied Liverpool Football Club through the entire 1980s. He was a player... To me, great players are players who can make other players look good as well. And it didn't matter who you partnered Alan Hansen with. He made anybody who played alongside him better. He made anybody who played alongside him look better. And I hate to bang on about it, but when Bruce Grobbelaar's your last line of defence, it's a good job you've got someone like Alan Hansen in defence, because my God, was he needed.
I love the fact, Stu. I mean, if you ever give up hosting these Football Times podcasts, you're going to go to politics, buddy. When you say, "I'm not going to mention," and then mention all those things. yeah, good one. Yeah. I'm going to come to you next, buddy. This is a player that, I mean, I always remember as being a wonderful player, but it's not about what I think. It's about you, how you convince me. So away you go, Aidan.
Okay, well, I'm going across the park from Stu's selection of Alan Hansen. We're going Kevin Ratcliffe. Now, not technically a one-club man. He may as well have been, frankly. He joined Everton as an apprentice and made his debut in March 1980, which is rather neat for a podcast about great players of the decade. I'm not picking people who were great in the late 70s and trying to shoehorn them in. Anyway, that day saw him shackle Manchester United's Joe Jordan in a goalless draw at Old Trafford. a successful start to an incredible career with Everton. He did initially struggle a little bit, though, generally playing at left back rather than his preferred central position. And the sliding door moment, though, was when he potentially may have moved to Bobby Robson's Ipswich. And then shortly after that, further frustrations led to a transfer request in 1982. But when the chance did come at the centre of defence, Ratcliffe took his opportunity and both he and Everton never looked back. He was a robust tackler, ferociously tough competitor, but he had a bit of style about him too. He was blessed with blistering pace, great ability to read the play. He was a complete defender, really, and the best in the league for some time, I would say. He only scored twice for Everton. But one of that pair was a 40-yard daisy cutter of a goal against Liverpool, of all teams, at Anfield. I don't know why the goalie that let that one in. But beyond infrequent moments like that, he was also a natural-born leader, a fact born out when he was made Everton captain at the age of just 23. This kind of accolade doesn't come the way of just anyone. It's a sign not only of his ability, but his character and his ability to lead, the indispensable nature that he brought to that team even at that age. Handily, it also allowed him to show off his trophy-lifting abilities too, and he was rather good at that. By the age of 24, he was already Everton's most successful captain, with more to come after that. His time as captain saw Everton enjoying the greatest era of their modern history, if not their entire history. Twice lifting the Division One trophy, a dodgy version of it in one occasion. Also winning an FA Cup and a European Cup Winners' Cup. Could easily have been more, with three losing FA Cup finals and a League Cup final defeat too. And who knows what European glory may have come their way had they been allowed to. This was Everton as a real power in English football. And Ratcliffe, with Southall behind him, steady pair of hands, and Reid ahead of him, was the central part in the spine of that side, the on-field leader and the beating heart of that team.
Good stuff. I mean, three classic centre-backs there for different reasons, and this is a tough one because I've got two of my favourite players in there, well, two of my favourite defenders of the year in there. So give me some thinking time, Chris. If we couldn't count your selection, Paul McGrath, who would you go for? Would you go for Hanson or Ratcliffe?
I'd play all three. I find the way of playing all three. I mean, such a tough call because actually Hanson, it was somebody who I admired hugely. Ratcliffe's an interesting one. It's such a strange career in many respects because, as Aidan said, he kind of struggled for the first couple of years, played left back, was left out in favour of Mark Higgins, another. And the guy who got sent off, I'm trying to remember his name, in the derby, and it's Liverpool, on his debut. And he struggled to make his name, but he got in and he was superb, you know, alongside Derek Mountfield. I honestly thought when Aidan said, I'm going to go across the park, I thought it was going to be Derek Mountfield. But Kevin Ratcliffe's a great defender, great captain, brilliant alongside Mountfield, brilliant alongside Watson. But Alan Hanson was such he's such a beautiful man. Not only a great defender, but he looked the part, you know. He had that little bit of a scar that made him a bit of a guy, a bit of a bloke, you know. But he had that elegance about him, that sort of, you know, try it on if you like, you know, but I'm here, I'm looking cool. He looked like he was the kind of defender who didn't sweat. You can imagine him taking his shirt off at the end of the game and it would still smell of Aramis, you know. And such a casual, languid guy who actually brought the ball out with ease. I think Stu said it, he had the ability to play out from the back, which in the 1980s, I think all three of our defenders actually had an ability to do that. But Hanson especially was a tricky, skillful player who could easily have made a name for himself in another position further up the field. And, you know, it's really strange that he... Not strange, but unfortunate that he quit when he did because of injury when he was still at a very, very high level. And it's scandalous that I think he got fewer than 30 Scotland caps, which is unbelievable. And in my view, and I am, of course, biased because I said Paul McGrath, if I had to pick the next guy alongside him, it would be Alan Hanson without any shadow of a doubt.
Stu, if you're going to sort of put the Aramis scent of Hanson's shirt to one side for a moment. McGrath or Ratcliffe, what would you go? Where would you go, bud?
I think it's a great point. I would be interested to see who else who we also picked on this list, because I think we've absolutely nailed the centre halves here as a back three. I honestly do. In the 80s, these are the iconic centre halves. It's a difficult one because I like players who maybe have a dark side, and that's not to say that Paul McGrath was a master of dark arts. He wasn't. I thought he was a fantastic defender, but you know, as Chris alluded to, his love of alcohol. There was always that side to him, that unknown, and I like players who have that. And you know, to quote Aidan, it makes them interesting, and I get it. I do like interesting footballers. I do, and so I like that about Paul McGrath, and I like his intelligence was. His ability to read the game was incredible, and probably I would argue probably better than Alan Hansen's. You know, out of all three of them, Paul McGrath's ability to read a game was incredible. Very, very rarely was he ever out of position, which is obviously the sign of a great centre half. And then likewise, when you come to Aidan's, I also love youth, and when youth is given its chance and youth is trusted, and like Aidan said, you know, Kevin Ratcliffe, captain, you know, in his early 20s. You know, and I'm a great admirer of managers who trust youth and trust youth with captaincy and trust youth in key positions, but also that almost foolhardy bravery of youth where it's okay, give me the job, I'll captain your side for you, I'll take you to league titles, you know, and I think I have a lot of respect for Kevin Ratcliffe, because they were going toe to toe with Liverpool at that time. But also that maturity beyond his years is incredible and you know demands respect. Again, if I'm going to judge it on playing for my life, on a one-off game, Paul McGrath in a one-off game.
Okay, that's fair comment. That's how close this is.
Yeah, and that's the only way I can do it, because I would play all three. I think it would be great.
Aidan, just getting your guy. Have you got the Aramis of Anson,
or the Guinness of Paul McGrath,
the whiff of alcohol and liniment, and even the skills with the grog. What would you say, buddy?
Well, I continue the theme the others have said, and as Stu said, it's interesting about who else each of us picked. These were the three that I picked, so you know I think we're consistent really across the board of the greatest three defenders of the decade. Equally, as Stu said, I like the interesting characters, and therefore Paul McGrath really appeals from that aspect. But if I'm talking football ability and style and impressive play and composure and all of that, I would go Hansen. I think he was my number one pick. Also, I'm slightly concerned that we're going to play into Stephen's hands here by picking too many Liverpool players, but I think in this case it's rather less contentious, and I think Alan Hansen is who I would pick.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, obviously, Liverpool were a sort of dominant team of this era, but yeah, I know what you're saying. And just to sort of clarify for anybody listening, each of the guys submit three choices, first, second, third choices to me. So that's nine selections. Of those nine selections, only one, which was a third choice selection, which didn't include these three guys. So that's how close this is, how consistent the guys' selections were. So I'm going to go through these sort of systematically. So Paul McGrath is a bit, to me, what he was, which a brilliant player. What it could have been is world class. If he hadn't had those dodgy knees, a bit like Ledley King sort of later day. I mean, it could have been absolutely one of the best defenders in the world, because he's got perishing everything. Kevin Ratcliffe.
No, I'm all right with that. What hybrid? Yeah, well, that's what I call myself in the backfield. Don't worry about it.
So I've got a friend called Stuart Ratcliffe. Sorry, mate, I slipped out.
Was he any good in defence?
No. He's not any good on a football pitch, let alone in defence. Kevin Ratcliffe was one of my favourite players. I always thought Kevin Ratcliffe would have been a brilliant libero as a sweeper. He got everything. Read the game well, good in the air, great defender, played, tackled well, never got flustered, great pass with the ball, pace to burn. I mean, Kevin Ratcliffe for me was a really outstanding player, but I think it's difficult to go beyond Hansen with the trophies won, and you know there again he played in a dominant team, but I think it would be churlish of me not to choose Hansen because you guys all chose him, so I think I've got to go with Alan Hansen. Right, we're moving into midfield now, guys, so it's going to get a little bit interesting now. So I'm going to start with you, Stu. for your midfield player. Let me just get the timer ready. 3 minutes. Tell me about your midfield player, buddy. Away you go.
Now this is where we do start going away from the boredom. This is now where we start stepping into the realms of who I thought I was in the backfield when I used to play. I have gone for a player who I defy anyone to say that they didn't enjoy watching this player, or this player didn't at times make them get out of the seat, or that they wouldn't pay to watch this player. I have gone with Glenn Hoddle. For me, because I am quite shallow actually when it comes to footballers, capable of incredible brilliance. Almost, the word genius is thrown around a lot. And again, we go back, we all watched football in the 80s. We know what the playing surfaces were like. We know how the tackles that were allowed that weren't even bookings. We know all of this. And yet, here was a player who just made the game look so easy, so easy. I think incredibly underestimated, underrated in terms of he was judged on what was very en vogue in the 80s of physicality. And certainly in England, that was what was prized above all other assets. Obviously played for Tottenham, 2 FA Cup wins, a UEFA Cup win. He then moves across to Monaco. So a player who was brave enough to go abroad and ply his talents abroad. Only 53 England caps, which is incredibly poor. It's an incredible injustice that he was only selected 53 times for his country. To quote Michel Platini, if he'd been French, he would have had 150 caps. And I think it's that. A player who was almost mocked or seen, I hate the phrase, seen as a luxury player. Glenn Hoddle was a player, and I looked through this, in the 1980s, only one season did he ever play less than 30 games in a season. In that season, he played 29. So, you know, he was consistent. He played, he never got injured. And like I say, I've never seen a player, certainly not an English player, make the game just look so, so simple. And when you can get away with a mullet, long hair and shirt untucked, I'm telling you, that's when you know you are a cult hero. And he was certainly a hero of mine.
Okay. 258.4 rights, Stu. That's pretty good timing, buddy. That's like a timing of a Glenn Hoddle pass, that is, buddy.
That's it.
Right, okay. Aidan, going to come to you next. Your player is perhaps a little bit different in approach to Glenn Hoddle. Away you go, mate.
Yeah, I've gone for Norman Whiteside, or to give him his full title, 17-year-old Norman Whiteside. He burst onto the scene as a kid with Manchester United and Northern Ireland in the early 80s. Sadly, but appropriately for a decade series like this, is within a decade, his senior career was also over. And yet he was seemingly permanently a teenager, always required to have his age mentioned alongside his name. I think that just adds to the appeal, frankly. The reason for that, though, was because he had the ability of someone much older, a child playing a man's game and playing it better than most of his elders. Given where he was from and where he ended up, he was, of course, frequently compared to George Best, even when still playing as a schoolboy and travelling across from Belfast to Manchester every weekend for training. As Whiteside himself said, to stoke the flames of that comparison, he said, "The only thing I have in common with George Best is that we come from the same place, play for the same club, and were discovered by the same man." He may not have quite had the astonishing level of skills that Best did, but he was a player of the highest class with a self-assurance that was impressive in one so young and excellent technique. He was one of those players who always seemed to have a little more time on the ball than everyone else. As Alex Ferguson, one of his managers at Manchester United, described him, he was an island of composure, always unhurried. He went on to describe Whiteside as close to genius category as well. So who am I to argue with him? He had become Manchester United's youngest player since Duncan Edwards when he made his debut, age 16, signing as a professional a couple of weeks later in 1982 when he turned 17. Within a week, he'd become the club's youngest ever goal scorer. And then he would also be the youngest scorer of a League Cup final goal with a terrific strike in defeat to Liverpool, and a scorer in an FA Cup final as well, thanks to a goal in the replay with Brighton in 83. He also became a star at the 82 World Cup, of course, as a 17-year-old, returned home to become a mainstay of the Man United team under Ron Atkinson. He did play up front occasionally, but I think it was a more attacking midfield where he really came into his own with Brian Robson alongside him. He was a revelation in the role with his intelligent play and positioning skills and ability to find the perfect key pass. We all, of course, remember his winning goal in the 85 FA Cup final. It's one of the greatest cup final winning goals, curling his shot brilliantly past Southall deep in extra time. That would prove to be the highest point of his club career, though, of course, his injury began to take hold. He had knee knack, a bit like Paul McGrath, but it couldn't be managed any better, unfortunately. But like the best rock legends, he burnt brightly but fizzled out all too soon. Make no mistake, though, Whiteside was a player of supreme ability and one whose brightest moments are fondly recalled as some of the finest of the 1980s.
Okay. Chris, coming on to you, we've got two different types of player there. Your guy is perhaps almost like an amalgam between the two there, matey. So tell me about your guy.
Well, the person I selected managed to have three broken legs, which is some doing, because most of us only have two legs, and yet this bloke is so superhuman. This guy is so superhuman that he carried his club throughout the 1980s, single-handedly in many respects. We're recording this on the 21st of March, which by my reckoning is 40 years to the day since this particular footballer had probably his greatest game against the greatest player in the world at that time, Diego Maradona. My selection is Brian Robson. I think Stu mentioned earlier about the players he wanted to be when he was a kid in the playground. Well, Brian Robson was the person I wanted to be. Absolutely ferocious footballer. And I will say this now. He was the most underrated footballer of his generation. And what I mean by that is that everyone associates Brian Robson as being this player of courage, this player of determination, this player of drive, the mental attributes that he brought to a team. But as a footballer, he was an all-rounder in every sense of the word. He was left-footed. And yet at West Brom during the late 70s and early 80s, he'd carved out a career playing in different positions. In 1980-81, he was the player, probably the player, according to his teammates, in the first division before he got the move to United. He went for a record fee, and rather than buckle under the pressure, he actually he was driven by it. You know, there's a great compilation on YouTube of Brian Robson's 26 goals for England, and the best goals were of his right foot. He was so underrated as a footballer. Everyone thinks of him as being this passionate person, but he had a range of passing. He had an ability to score goals. He had an ability to read the game. He had an ability to defend, position himself in the right place. If this was a discussion about the best players of the 20th century, I would be putting forward this guy. That's how highly I think of him. And yeah, I wanted to be him in the playground because Brian Robson, in my view, was the best midfielder of his generation and many more.
Okay. It's great. This is good. I like this one because we basically, aside from the goalkeepers and the defenders, we've got a sort of a real spread of opinions here. So this is a good one to think about. So while I do that, starting with you, Stu, if we put the Tottenham star away and look at two Man United players, who would you go for, bud?
Again, I suppose I come back to my previous argument. I feel like I'm stuck on repeat here. You can't argue with the 17-year-old Norman Whiteside. Even when he was 22, he was still the 17-year-old Norman Whiteside. Everything he had said, you know, he's right. He was, you know, he was an incredible talent. And the trust, like I said about Kevin Ratcliffe, the trust, early 20s is one thing, but to be playing at Old Trafford as a 17-year-old, that's a completely different level to then become at the time the youngest player ever to play in a World Cup finals. You know, these are sort of world records that you're sort of talking about here in terms of the history of the game. Unfortunately, Braden. it's a short career span, and you know, and Aidan's analogy of him being a rock star is absolutely right. And you kind of want your rock stars to burn bright and then blow up. That's exactly what you want from your rock stars. Brian Robson, there's no denying his ability and his ability to galvanize a team, galvanize players around him, play through injuries, and obviously be the leader of men. But I would imagine that if you were in a team that had Brian Robson sat in your changing rooms, you'd be a happy man. And if you were in a team where Brian Robson was sat in the opposition changing rooms, you would be a very wary man. And I think for the longevity of the career, and I think ability to galvanise players and very ordinary teams, Manchester United, I'm going to go with Brian Robson.
Okay, good argument. Aidan, if Norman was one to put to one side, as he was quite early in his career, sadly, Brian Robson or Glenn Hoddle?
This is a tough one because they are so utterly, utterly different. Purely from an aesthetic perspective, I'm drawn to Glenn Hoddle for that. But equally, Brian Robson, I think what Stu said at the end there was kind of interesting. Of if you were had hit Brian Robson in your dressing room, you'd feel good about it. And I think you'd feel more that with Brian Robson than you would with Hoddle, perhaps. I don't know. I'm really torn on this one. I do associate Brian Robson a lot with injuries, and that's obviously from his time with England and not that much success. Whereas, of course, Glenn Hoddle played for Tottenham and didn't have that much success either. So that really hasn't helped me. I think I'll probably just slightly go for Brian Robson. Glenn Hoddle was very, very good, but disappeared off to France and was even better, or Monaco. And therefore, I'll go with the one who stayed, if that helps.
Okay. Chris, put Brian Robson away for a second and tell me about your choice between Norman Whiteside and Glenn Hoddle.
Well, I've got to say, I always think Norman Whiteside's goal in the 85 Cup Final was my favourite ever Cup Final goal. It was the first Cup Final I remember watching from start to finish, and it was such a glorious bend on the ball, and the way it just knocked Neville Southall's bottle over in the corner of that goal was supreme. And he was 16. He's forever 16, forever 17, 18. He never goes old. Never grows old, does he, Norman? Despite being called Norman. But I've got to go with Glenn Hoddle. It's really interesting that during the 80s, I didn't appreciate Glenn Hoddle. I said I was very much in the Brian Robson camp as a youngster, as a kid growing up. But it's only when you actually get to watch Glenn Hoddle and the way he the ability he had, the range of passing he had. It was interesting that Stu mentioned that he was underused for England. And this is what slightly turns me towards Norman a little bit. When Hoddle did play for England, he didn't actually play that well. You know, he played in the 86 World Cup a few games. He played in 88. And he never really showed the kind of form he showed for Tottenham. However, he was an outstanding footballer. He couldn't sing for love nor money. but there was something about him. There was an arrogance where I think Brian Robson epitomised the north of England. Glenn Hoddle had the south wrapped up, I always felt. There was a real north-south divide. I'm going to go, even though it might compromise my own choice, I am going to go with Glenn Hoddle, simply because I know that if I don't, then he'll probably find a way of hitting me with a ball from 50 miles away. So I'm going to go with Glenn Hoddle.
I've been swayed a little bit by these, that there were sort of summaries afterwards, after you made your pictures there, guys. So, I mean, firstly, Norman Whiteside, I think there again, a talent could tragically short and, you know, good, great player that he was, you know, perhaps could have been so much better afterwards. And I feel a little bit about the same for Glenn Hoddle, not because of an injury, but because when he decided to move abroad, he didn't go to Italy. He didn't go to Spain. He went to sort of France, which is, you know, okay, that's fine. But, yeah, it's not where the top players play. which leaves me with Brian Robson. I think the other thing with comparison is, on the international stage, Hoddle never really excelled, whereas Brian Robson did for England. And, you know, as Steve said, it's a good point that, you know, if you've got Brian Robson in your dressing room, you're far better at having him there than in the other guy's dressing room. So I'm going to go with Brian Robson. Yeah, it's a difficult one because they're three different types of players. I mean, goalkeepers are goalkeepers, and we pick three centre-backs. So they're sort of fairly easy to compare. But, you know, when you look at three midfield players of different types, it's difficult. But, yeah, I'm going to go with Brian Robson. So let's go to the sharp end of the game. We're going to look at forwards. I can't remember whose turn it is, but I'm going to go with you, Aidan, first. I hope I'm right. So your forward, I mean, we've got three cracking choices of forwards here. So away you go, buddy.
Okay, well, there can, of course, only be one greatest striker of the 1980s, and that man is, of course, the boyhood Everton fan, Ian Rush. It was in red rather than blue where he became a legend, of course. Goal machine. His goals were, of course, pivotal to lots of Liverpool's dominance across the decade. Nobody scored more goals in English football in that era, the 1980s, that is, even despite his disappointing one-year sojourn in Juventus. He joined Liverpool in 1980 from Chester. Again, neat for our decade's narrative. And other than a few sporadic appearances there when others were injured, though, that first year at Liverpool was mainly spent in the reserves, learning the Liverpool way, I guess, waiting for his chance, learning how to become more clinical. He nearly slipped the net at this time in search of a regular first team place, but thankfully for those of a red persuasion, the opportunity did come his way at Liverpool. His first real season in the first team was the next one, and he hit 30 goals across all competitions, even at that stage, to become the club's top scorer, helping Liverpool retake the league title and win the League Cup. And they achieved the same the very next year, and it was only then that Rush became the PFA Young Player of the Year into the bargain. The goals just kept on flowing, though, most famously perhaps when he hit four in an away victory over Everton. I'm sure the boyhood Evertonian always dreamed of scoring freely at Goodison, and his dream came true. His goal scoring reached an astonishing peak in 1984 when he scored 47 goals in 65 games as part of winning three trophies that year. Who can then forget, a couple of years later, his camera-smashing winning goal in the 86 FA Cup final, one of the most iconic of cup winners. But it seems almost churlish to me to pick out some of his goals since there were just so many. He enjoyed a remarkable, lethal partnership with the great Kenny Dalglish in the early years, the strengths of one seemingly perfectly complementing the other, making for a rather intimidating front line. But even post-Dalglish, Rush remained as ruthless as ever in front of goal. And like the very best, when he was bearing down on goal, you generally knew what the outcome was going to be. But he wasn't a simply stereotypically selfish centre-forward either. He had a bit of that. All great goal scorers do. But he was also a very hard worker, pressing from the front as we'd know it these days, hassling and harrying the defenders and the goalies. You kind of just imagine how many extra goals he might have had the back pass rule been in place in those days. As a finisher, though, he was calm and clinical, a bit Jimmy Greaves-esque in some ways, but he could score a variety of goals. The only thing that didn't seem to vary was the frequency with which he found the net. But far beyond most other top goal scorers, it's his all-round work and team ethic that marked him out as a little different, a step beyond most other elite centre-forwards in that respect. Add in the ridiculous number of goals, and you've simply got one of the very greatest strikers of all time, clearly the greatest of the 80s.
2 minutes, 58.1. I mean, you had a second to spare there, Aidan. You wasted that second.
Sorry.
You'll never get it back. Chris, so we got Ian Rush as an advocate suggested by Aidan. Beat that, buddy.
I'm going to go for his teammate, his international teammate, Mark Hughes, who I always felt, if you disregard the hair, you have an iconic striker who had everything, really, apart from the hair. The hair was bad. Let's get that out of the way. Get the negatives gone. Okay, the hair was bad, but wow, what a footballer. With his back to goal, absolutely fantastic. He had this 5'9", you know. He was a little bit Dalglish-esque in respect to the fact that he made himself extremely wide when he was backing into defenders, but he had something different. He had the ability to score the spectacular. You think of that Man City game where they lose 5-1 overhead kick. The very brilliant goal for Spain, against Spain for Wales, the bicycle kick. But there was more to Mark Hughes. He had the ability to bring footballers into play. other players around him, Jesper Olsen, Gordon Strachan, Brian Robson, Remy Moses, Frank Stapleton, later on Brian McClare, Peter Davenport, people like that. He made others around him play better, even if they weren't at his level. And the big thing about Mark Hughes, he was a big-time player. He played in the big games. You know, you often hear about these footballers who perform and then they don't quite do it in the games that matter. Eric Cantona maybe was one that was sort of highlighted as never doing it in the Champions League. Well, Mark Hughes did it when it mattered. The 85 FA Cup semi-final, he scored. The 85 final against Everton, he set the goal up for Norman Whiteside. Later on against Crystal Palace, he scored a couple of brilliant goals. And again, he appeared for that match. Barcelona in 91, he scored, I think, twice, possibly. Steve Bruce maybe stole one of them. But he was just a big-time player who left Man United to go to Barcelona, went to Bayern Munich, and get this, by the way, he played two games in one day for Bayern Munich and Wales. I defy you to find any footballer who would do that. And yet he had such a brilliant career at the very highest level, an intelligent footballer. He wasn't prolific, never prolific, but he was somebody who knew how to play other players into space, create space for others, take defenders out of the game by foul means or fair means. He was just an overall brilliant, brilliant centre forward, Mark Hughes.
2 minutes 54.64 there, Chris. There again, you wasted 5 seconds, but you know, you still delivered a great pitch there, buddy. Stu, we've got two Welsh guys. Who are you going to pitch against them? Another Welsh guy, a Scots, an Irishman, or it's going to be away you go?
Okay, so I'm going to open with mine. So across the entire history of men's association football across the globe, only 22 people have achieved something. And my guy is one of them in men's football. And that is to be a World Cup Golden Boot winner. So I'm just going to let that sit. Okay, so I've gone with Gary Lineker. So Glenn Hoddle was discounted based on his performances for England, so we'll rectify that for a start, straight off the bat. And while we're talking about straight off the bat, he was also good enough to play county cricket for Leicestershire Seconds as well. So Gary Lineker, I'm not going to say the perfect goal scorer, but not far away. If you want somebody like your goalkeepers to be consistent and reliable, Gary Lineker was your penalty box goal scorer. 6 goals in the 86 World Cup, season winner Golden Boot, all 6 are scored inside the 6-yard box. That's what you want. You don't need spectacular. Aidan makes a great point about Ian Rush with his 4 goals. Yeah, brilliant. Lineker does that against Spain in Spain. Okay, that's just straight off the bat as well. Division 1 leading goal scorer with the recently promoted minnow that was Leicester City. Repeats the fact again with English giants Everton. So it doesn't matter which team is in, what level they come from, the man scores goals. Brave enough to go abroad. Again, Glenn Hoddle was discounted because he only went to France. So I'm giving you Lineker at the Camp Nou. He goes to Barcelona. 3 seasons. Doesn't just come home a bit homesick, like Ian Rush after 1 year in Italy, because it's all a bit foreign. Gary's the man, sees it out, immerses himself in the Catalonian culture, wins the Cup Winners' Cup, learns under Johan Cruyff. He is, like I say, quick, an eye for goal. Not only that, 48 international goals in just 80 appearances, 10 of which, over a fifth, of his international goals come in World Cup finals, not qualifiers, World Cup finals, okay? A Golden Boot winner, like I say, with Leicester, a Golden Boot winner with Everton, a Golden Boot winner at the Men's World Cup, 461 league appearances across Barcelona, Leicester, Everton, Tottenham, 238 goals, over a goal every 2 games. I've heard your arguments about why you're discounting Glenn Hoddle, so I give you all the counter arguments with Gary Lineker.
He went 0.36 of a second over Stubble. I'll give you that one, mate. Okay.
Disqualify him.
Argument sentence.
Yeah. Okay. 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 So let's. This is a difficult one. I didn't think it was going to be, but it is. Aiden, without Ian Rush, tell me.
I think. Well, I mean, these are three excellent players. Let's just say that. I think to me, Mark Hughes was a scorer of great goals, but not a great goal scorer. He was a good player, but I don't think he's on the level of the other two as a goal scorer. And I think if we're picking best forwards, I think goal scoring ability comes into that quite significantly. So to me, that then gives us Lineker and Rush. Sure, Lineker scored four at Spain, but Spain were crap in those days, Stu.
That's okay.
And I'll give you those World Cup goals, but some of those came in the 90s. That's another little thing. You know, you were big about what you were counting and what you weren't counting before. But it's almost impossible to split the two. I think, you know, the 85-86 season, when we got to see them both going head-to-head and then head-to-head in the cup final that year, was peak for this discussion, I think. And, well, who scored more goals in that game? I'll leave that hanging. But if I'm picking between Lineker and Hughes, I would absolutely pick Gary Lineker. I mean, he was a brilliant goal scorer. I absolutely loved him for England. He scored, as Stu says, he scored a lot in a poor or average team initially. When he broke through, no, he was an excellent, excellent goal scorer. So yeah, I would go for him out of the other two.
It's a nice sort of empathetic finish after you've gone over the top of the ball.
I'm just picking him up.
Yeah,
by the
I was going to say
there,
you clattered the player. You're patching him on there, helping him to his feet. There, yeah. Good play. I mean, the referee might get away, give you a yellow card, but you might get away with it there because you picked him up at the end. So fair play, Chris. If you put Mark Hughes to one side, you've got two guys who found the net with alarming regularity in the 80s with Ian Rush and Gary Lineker. Different players, I guess, but what would you think?
Well, you mentioned yellow cards there. Well, that's one thing Gary Lineker won't win, is it? I mean, such a nice boy, and I'm surprised Stu went for such a nice boy, really. Like, he's actually footballers, and there he is putting Gary Lineker in. Now, Your Honour, Your Excellency, Mr. Adjudicator, I would like to remind you that Gary Lineker, Ian Rush, Norman Whiteside, Brian Robson all did rather well from having a certain other Welshman in the team. And I shall say no more in that respect. But if I'm to cast Mark Hughes aside just for this moment, it's a very difficult one, this, because I think Gary Lineker was a success overseas, maybe more so than Ian Rush was. But Gary Lineker, I'm mindful of our great friend Paul McFarlane, who also always points to the fact that Everton perhaps should have done better with Gary Lineker and maybe had to change the way they played to accommodate him. And that has stuck with me. I'm also mindful of the fact that he was one of these footballers who seemed to raise his game when England played, as opposed to at club level. He was a better player at international level almost than he was at club level at times. And sure, he had a very good career for Leicester, Everton and Tottenham in England and Barcelona abroad. But Ian Rush, I mean, you have to look at his record when he joined from Chester, and he didn't score for about 9 months. Now, in modern football, you do not survive that. You would end up being loaned out. You'd end up being jettisoned back down to another club. Liverpool kept faith with him, and what a reward. You know, a phenomenal goal scorer. I think Aidan summed it up there. He went back to Goodison, scored four goals against Everton, his boyhood club. And not only that, but he went to Italy. He experienced that lifestyle, that system of play, and he came back a different footballer. And yet he came back and still produced performances going well into the 90s. And I know we're not here to talk about the 90s, but he did adapt his game. He learned how to change his game. And I think for the effect he had, the impact he had, the trophies he won, as much as I like Gary Lineker, in many respects. I'm going to have to go with Mark Hughes' international teammate rather than Mark Hughes' club teammate. I'll go with Ian Rush.
Okay, good stuff, Chris. Stu, picture the two Welshmen for me.
Okay, first of all, Mark Hughes' goal for Wales was also recreated in the backfield numerous times, incredibly unsuccessfully, bar probably a couple that I connected with. A lot of tellings off for grass stains on the knees. However, it was a goal that is right up there in my top five of all-time goals. It is simply stunning. And Aidan's right. Mark Hughes was a scorer of great goals rather than a great goal scorer. Ian Rush, I will concede, was a great goal scorer in a great team. And that's okay. That's great. If you need all that help, that's fine. Gary Lineker could score goals all by himself in any team, no matter where you put him in. Whether it's debate, it was a very average Leicester City side, but he was still top goal scorer. Again, Chris is right. Gary Lineker, very nice boy, never booked, but was brave enough to stick it out abroad. He was brave enough to stay there and try and make it work and embed himself and not come home after just a year, which, you know, obviously some of the nominees have done that. But I will admit to the fact that, again, it comes down to the same argument. If I need someone to score me a goal and I'm not allowed to pick my mate Gary, then it's got to be Ian Rush every day of the week. If I need somebody to score me a goal, he's the person. He's the person I'm asking to do it for me. But only if it's in Liverpool red, in the city of Liverpool. I won't ask him anywhere else to do it for me.
And there we go with just a late tackle from Stu there, just as the ball has gone. You know, I looked at these three and I thought this is going to be a on the nod. This is almost, you know, Ian Rush. You've got to give it Ian Rush, but I'm not going to. I think Lineker, because he scored goals for poor teams. I mean, all the teams he played for, Leicester, Everton, Tottenham, weren't as good as Liverpool. And he still scored goals and went abroad and succeeded with Barcelona as well, whereas Rush didn't. I mean, I just can't believe I'm sort of swayed by the arguments you all gave in favour of Lineker. I mean, all three of you. Yeah, I'm going to go with Lineker. I just think that's is the guy did it at the and England as well, international level. Rush, not so much. And I guess Rush is playing for a poorer Welsh team than Lineker was playing for a fairly successful England team. Yeah, I'm going to go with Lineker. Yeah, you know, I'm persuaded by the argument, and that's what it's all about on this. And it's great to have, you know, these passionate arguments. And I think that the last one, the managers, we've got three classic candidates here. And I just want to say, guys, keep your eye on the ball. Well, that's all I'm saying. I'm going to start with you, Chris. Tell me about your manager of the 80s who should win, buddy. Away you go.
This is a guy, very quiet, very unassuming. He was already heading fast into his 70s during the 1980s. You know, he'd taken over from Bill Shankly as Liverpool manager, and he won 20 major honours in his time as Liverpool manager. Most successful manager in the club's history, by the way, Jurgen, Kenny Dalglish, etc., etc. Most successful English manager of all time. He basically won honours at a rate of 2.2 per season, which only Pep Guardiola has beaten, by the way. This guy wasn't an obvious football manager. He was a working class guy from up north, a very quiet, reserved guy. No, I think we'd all admit he had no particular charisma in the way that a Brian Clough did or an Alex Ferguson or Ron Atkinson or Malcolm Allison did. But he was a winner and he knew how to build teams. And I think his greatest achievement, Bob Paisley's greatest achievement, apart from taking over from Bill Shankly and winning Liverpool's first ever European Cup in 1977, was not only repeating that a year later, but in the early 80s, because we are talking about the 80s here, was rebuilding an all-conquering, brilliant Liverpool team with what was effectively his phase two. You know, rebuilding, bringing in the likes of Ian Rush, bringing in the likes of Ronnie Whelan, Sammy Lee, Bruce Grobbelaar, Alan Hansen, and starting a new generation of Liverpool players who would go on to conquer Europe again when he was manager and after he left. And make no mistake, you know, Joe Fagan won the European Cup, Kenny Dalglish won the league and cup double. But the basis of those success stories came from the guy who built Liverpool up post Shankly. And by the way, to follow a guy like Bill Shankly and achieve such success and become the most successful English manager of all time, I'm looking forward to hearing who Stuart and Aidan put forward, because I think they're going to really have to raise their game to match the achievements and the honours that Bob Paisley brought to Liverpool.
Well, Stu, can you raise an argument against it? Challenged by Chris there. Away you go.
I also have gone for a Liverpool manager with, in his first stint, a win percent of 60.9%. The player-coach role is an incredibly difficult role. Although I don't know why I'm saying that because I've never been one. But a player-coach role, I assume, must be a really difficult role to take on. And my choice is Kenny Dalglish, who... And I'm going to come to the main reason why I picked him in a little while. I'm going to discount that a lot of Chris's chat, and it was great, but a lot of it was very 70s based. But that's okay. So in the 80s, Dalglish, two league titles. Obviously, as Chris mentioned, the first double. He also scores the winning goal as player manager to win the double at Chelsea, that famous goal. Two FA Cups. Arguably, the man should have had three doubles, realistically, in four seasons, but for a jarring Wimbledon victory and a Michael Thomas goal in the last minute, it should have been three doubles for Liverpool Football Club. We talk about Dalglish, the manager, and Chris makes a great point, and I also agree with him in that a manager's ability to rebuild sides and regenerate clubs. And Dalglish, for me, produced created the greatest Liverpool side I've ever seen. In the 87-88 season, they were, for me, the second best or up there on a par with the greatest side I've ever watched and had the privilege of watching. And certainly over an elongated season, they were an incredible side who literally played fantasy football. But I think the reason I'm going with Dalglish is because he picked up the mantle of manager in probably Liverpool's darkest hours. And that's not to use it as an excuse to pick. I'm not doing it for that vote, and I need to make that clear right now. But I think when you are offered the managerial role post-Heysel and you have to deal with that and you have to deal with the aftermath of that and you have to deal with a club that can't play in Europe and how you still attract players to your football club, but then on top of that, you have Heysel. I talked about Alan Hansen being the captain, but certainly Dalglish as the manager, purely by the role he had assumed and the role he had, became almost a touch point for an entire city and for an entire football club. And not only his job was a football manager, and that's what he's being judged on. But I think more than that, I think he saved Liverpool Football Club and held the fans and the club together.
Okay, 258.77, Stu. Yeah, that's pretty good, matey. Yeah. Aidan, now, are you staying on the red side of Liverpool? Are you moving over? Or are you going to an entirely different city? I know the answer, by the way, but, you know, tell me about it.
Yes, you know the answer, and we are staying in that city, but now we're going blue. They say you should never go back. It'll never be as good as the first time around. As it is in life, so it is in football, usually. But for Howard Kendall, the lure of the club he'd spent the prime years of his playing days at was far too much for him to resist on several occasions, if we're looking ahead to the 90s as well. But unlike so many being able to resist the pull of their former glories, Howard Kendall not only became an Everton hero all over again, but he surpassed his playing achievements and much more beyond in the first of those stints as Everton manager. But unlike either of the two other managers that have been mentioned here, he inherited a sorry mess of a club, and he set about the transformation process in a shrewd manner. The initial lack of rapid rise to glory may have seen him ousted from the club initially, but he remained, he did, and the rest, as they say, is history. He dragged the club from the doldrums and turned them into the finest in the country, one of the outstanding teams of the late 20th century. Though we never got to find out if he could have made them the finest in Europe is perhaps one of the reasons that Howard Kendall isn't generally named among the greatest English managers. Perhaps, too, the fact that he was in an era of the likes of Paisley, Dalglish, Joe Fagan as well across the park, and Clough and Bobby Robson, I guess, whose profiles were all a bit higher than Kendall. That left him dwell a little bit in their shadows when it comes to wider attention. But to me, I think the success he built at Everton, how quickly he did it, how he crafted a team in every sense of the word, created a unit based on players plucked either from obscurity or a little bit under the radar or just a little bit down on their luck, was remarkable. To have competed with and toppled their city neighbours more than once at this time was a huge achievement. They came ever so close, doing so on more occasions too, but regardless of missed opportunities to win a double in 85 and again in 86, this really shouldn't take away from just how big an achievement this was to me. One look at what happened to Everton after he left, the brief revival when he returned, and then the rapid slide into disappointment that followed again just marks out his greatness in the 80s all the more. He is quite simply, to me, the greatest and most successful manager that Everton's ever had, one of the best English managers of recent times, and I think deserves to be recognised as such. Perhaps is a little bit under the radar at times when these discussions are had, but I think he deserves to hog much more of the headlines than he usually does.
Okay, so this is a very Merseyside-centric challenge. Chris, if you put your selection to one side of Mr. Paisley, Dalglish or Kendall, obviously a different generation of Paisley, but sort of a similar generation of those two, what do you think?
God, this is the toughest choice, actually, I think, because, do you know, I was never that impressed by Dalglish. I know he won the double, but then when Stu reeled off the achievements, the fact that he was so close to winning three doubles and the notion that he took over after Heysel, which was a monumentally difficult time for Liverpool, gave a lot of weight to Dalglish. And the fact that he did it while he was still wearing his football boots, by the way, which is even more remarkable. Player managers are something we simply don't hear anything about these days. But then I'm thinking about Aidan and Howard Kendall, and I'm thinking about the utter malaise of the early 1980s at Everton when he was losing his way so badly, and he elevated Colin Harvey into a more senior role. But it was his management that allowed for that, and his judgment on players that brought people like Trevor Stephen, Peter Reid, Graham Sharp, Andy Gray, Van den Heer, etc., to the club, Derek Mountfield, and made them into the best team in the country very quickly. You know, it wasn't a piecemeal. It was like that. He did it with a click of the fingers. They went from nowhere to being within a whisker of not only, well, they did win the league in 85, could have won the double in 86, ended up toothless, but actually were very, very worthy contenders for both competitions, domestic competitions. Who knows what they could have done in Europe had, or in the European Cup, had Heysel not happened. This should have been an open and shut case, really, for Kendall. Stu's given me a lot to think about with Dalglish, and I think you cannot discount the brilliance of his work when he took over. But I'm going to lean back towards the platform that Bob Paisley built and Joe Fagan continued. And I'm going to go with Howard Kendall because he didn't have that. He built it from scratch, and Everton might have gone as quickly as they came and emerged. But wow, what a 3 years that was. And it, do you know what? There's a real lovely symmetry here about it happening right in the middle of the 1980s, right at the very peak of the decade or the middle of the decade that we're talking about. One end and the other end, not so great, right in the middle, slap bang in the Miami Vice era of football, that mid-1980s, Live Aid, et cetera, et cetera. There are Everton with their mullets, their short shorts and their Hafnir shirts. And I'm all for that. Viva Howard Kendall.
That's correct. Stu, can you fight that cheerleading of Chris there for the guy from across Stanley Park?
To be fair, Chris is dead right. When we did this, this was the one I was looking forward to the most, to what everyone had to say. Because managers, people's opinions of footballers are very straightforward, but people's opinions of managers are always a lot more complex, and why people admire certain managers. So this was the one I was really excited for. And I kind of guessed Howard Kendall would be there, and I kind of knew Bob Paisley would be there. So I'm quite pleased that the three that I thought we would end up with are the three that we've got. And like Chris, I sort of gone the other way, and I thought, well, it'll be Bob Paisley, and I can't. Yes, I get Howard Kendall, but the way Aidan articulated it, and management is about managing clubs, and it is that ultimately that's what it's about. It's about managing clubs and managing teams, which obviously, like I say, is why I went with Dalglish. But what to go from nothing to brilliance? You know, that it's the responsibility. Yeah, the players are involved, but it's the responsibility of Howard Kendall, and he did it. He instigated it. Colin Harvey's brought on board, but like Chris said, you know, it's under Kendall's watch, and he allows that to happen. You know, and it's his choice of signings and his choice of players and bringing players in. And when Kendall goes, you know, it's just there. It's beautifully encapsulated with Howard Kendall's time at Everton, and there's no getting away from that. But I'm going to have to stay true to myself. I really wanted to be Howard Kendall, and I genuinely did. But I'm going to be consistent. And if I have to, you pick a manager to win a game of football for my life, I have to look at Bob Paisley. He's who I would pick to win a game of football for my life. But I didn't think Howard Kendall would come even close, but he really does.
So, Aidan. These two guys have had pretty good pitches for your guy, but you've got to put him away for a second now and pick between two Liverpool legends.
Well, before we get to that, I would say if Paisley was managing a game for your life, would that game have been in the 70s, Stu, or the 80s?
It would have been in the 79-80 season.
Oh, I see.
Over the top, here we go again. Studs up, shin pads flying everywhere.
Yeah. Okay, if I'm talking about Paisley and Dalglish, to me, the infinitely greater manager of the two is, without question, Bob Paisley, for all the reasons Chris talked about. However, I don't see him as a hugely significant 80s character. Okay, he did win a European title in the 80s, so that might be slightly daft. But he was manager from 74 to 83. That's the majority being the 70s. I get everything Chris said about the foundations and all of that. And I think that leads into the Dalglish thing. Frankly, anyone could have led Liverpool to glory in those days, frankly. You know, you could have just laced up any other players could have thrown their boots in the corner and become player manager and led them to several titles, to be honest. And all that fantasy football they had, well, you know, they bought Barnes and Beardsley. What do you expect? I could have led them to glory. But everything else Stu said about Dalglish, I equally appreciate, you know, the dark days that he led them through. And that, I think, shows astonishing leadership that is part of the role of the manager, the being the representative of the club, the city, and all of that. I think that elevated him beyond simply a great football manager. And yeah, joking aside, I still think he was a very good manager. It's a shame he didn't quite carry that on in the Northeast. But he was a very, very good manager. I don't think he could hold a candle to Bob Paisley as a manager, but if we're talking 80s, I might, because of the length of time and the iconic moments of the 1980s that he oversaw, I would pick Dalglish of the two. But, you know, I wouldn't pick either of them above Howard Kendall. Anyone could manage Liverpool in those days. Anyone.
They're all good arguments. And, you know, it's I think it's difficult to look at the success of Bob Paisley and say he only won a European Cup in the 80s and sort of dismiss it as if it's nothing. So, but I think, you know, the very fact that he was only manager there till 83, I think. If he was across the 70s and the 80s, no arguments. I think it would be Paisley, but I think because of it's only there for 3 years, makes it a little bit difficult to go with Paisley. Dalglish took over a team, was runners up, European Cup final. You know, the half the Heysel tragedy, but you know, still a team that got to the European Cup final. So you know, he's taking over a team that had you know, a lot of great players in there. So, and then added to it as well. Whereas Kendall picked up, Lineker picked up a team that was you know, on its uppers, as it were, and then made them the best team in the country. And I mean, it seems strange. And I'm having already turned down Ian Rush, I'm going to upset our good mate Stevie Scrat by turning down two Liverpool managers and then picking an Everton manager on top of it. So sorry, Stevie, but I think I'm going to go with Howard Kendall because of the arguments not only made by Aidan, but also by the other guys as well, who sort of, you know, competed the success of Kendall. So despite all this going over the top of the ball, guys, I mean, you know, they've been supportive of each other's choice as well. So, okay, so I think that's going to be our Mount Rushmore for the 80s. Goalkeeper, Bruce Grobbelaar. Defender, Alan Hansen. So, Stevie, you've got two Reds in there, so you'll be okay, Tiger. Brian Robson in midfield. Striker, forward, Gary Lineker, and manager, Kendall. So I was going to say massive thanks to our three advocates. Aidan, thank you very much, mate. I don't know if the white couch is going to be booked out for me again. But
you've redeemed yourself a bit, except on the Ian Rush one. I was a bit shocked at that.
Well, you know, Chris, enjoyed it, buddy?
I have, yeah. It was brilliant and more and actually tougher than I thought it would be to try and decide who to go with when my choice had been put on hold. So, yeah, I really enjoyed that. And I think we've got the backbone of a very, very good team there.
Good stuff, buddy. I agree. Stu, there you again. You're not in the host chair, so you get back there soon, but I'll keep the seat warm for you. Enjoy being on the other side of the table, buddy.
I tell you what, Aidan's a formidable person to have a podcast with. He can cop for some more awkward questions. Wait till it's his book.
Oh dear!
Yeah, there was so much off the ball stuff, Gary. I don't know where you were looking for after that podcast. But yeah, it was. It's been great. I've absolutely loved it. And you know, like Chris, you know, Chris mentioned Live Aid and that 1985 element. I think we really hit the sweet spot of the 1980s in this episode. And I think even with reserves, we've made some great choices. And like you said about how close we all were, I think shows what connoisseurs of 1980s football we actually are.
I think you are, guys. And, you know, I think, you know, I just sort of let the game flow sometimes. It's what you do, you know. Nobody wants to watch a boring game. It's a little bit of passion. Helps them to move the game along. So thanks very much, guys. So now it's over to you, listeners. We'd love to hear some feedback from you, our audience. Did the guys make the good choices? Were the pitches convincing for their selections? Who did we miss out? And who should have been considered? And of course, did the judge make the right decision? Of course I did. Since that would be great to hear from you, your thoughts on Twitter, just tag @thesefootballtimes and hashtag TFTMRD. That's These Football Times Mount Rushmore Debate, TFTMRD. And let us know. We want to hear your thoughts. So thanks for listening and catch us next time on the LARP podcast from These Football Times.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.